Shrink Wrap Radio number 535, Maximizing Effectiveness in Dynamic Psychotherapy, with Dr. Patricia Coughlin.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Patricia Coughlin, PhD, who trains and practices intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy. We'll be discussing her 2017 book, Maximizing Effectiveness in Dynamic Psychotherapy. For more information about Patricia Coughlin, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Once again, today's episode is sponsored by Swellbe.com, a new online marketplace for health and wellness providers to manage and market their practice, free and easy to use. Sign up today at Swellbe.com. Now, here's the interview. Patricia Coughlin, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm really pleased to have you on the show. You have written such a fine book here. It's such a fine book. It's called Maximizing Effectiveness in Dynamic Psychotherapy. And, of course, you are of the tradition of, and I always block on the initials.
Yeah, it's a little bit long, ISTDP. It's term dynamic psychotherapy. Yeah.
Right. And as you know, I've had several other guests on this topic, and it's great to have you take us even further today. And because I know you, this book really is a synthesis of a lot of years of experience, a lot of thought, and a lot of training that you've done, not only of yourself, but of other people.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's interesting when you say, yes, of course, I'm known for ISTDP, but my training and my orientation, you know, started out as a very traditional psychoanalytic, psychodynamic one, which I think gave me the advantage of having such a wonderful theoretical base.
Yes.
But I started to get frustrated, you know, after 7 or 8 years of traditional practice, just knowing that I wasn't being as effective as I could be. And when I discovered ISTDP, Dr. Davenport's work, it was like a duck to water. Finally, I had some of the tools to really work with the dynamic unconscious and get much more consistent results, deeper results more quickly. And I've written 2 books about ISTDP.
Then 2 other books, yeah.
Yeah. And this, in a way, I very intentionally did not have ISTDP in the title.
Mm-hmm.
Back to dynamic psychotherapy to, again, really integrate theory and technique, and to get ISTDP a bit more in the center of the discussion, because I think it's many people still don't know about it.
Yeah, and interestingly, you say that you felt before you got
ISTDP. Yeah.
Yeah. Boy, I've got to get. I actually made a note to myself here. Yes, ISTDP. I don't know why I keep scrambling up those initials, but you said that you actually, before you got into that, that you didn't feel fully effective, and so you actually, in this latest book, you cite some studies that indicate that maybe 50%. Of therapists are not operating at the highest level of competence that would be available to them. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, it's interesting that bell-shaped curve just keeps popping up all over the place. And so therapists, just like physicians, attorneys, teachers, seem to fall along this bell-shaped curve. So most of the people are somewhere in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the 20% of therapists on the left side who do better and more consistently effective work than the rest. You also have some people over there on the right side of that bell-shaped curve who actually do damage and you should definitely stay away from.
Yeah.
So, you know, the issue is that if you have, let's say, an average problem, you know, you've gotten depressed subsequent to a breakup, or you have some anxiety about getting into medical school or something, you know, one of those average therapists is probably going to be able to help you. But it's the people who have more complex disorders of longer standing, and it looks like about 80% of our patients actually fall into that category.
Right, sure.
You know, they've tried lots of treatments, they haven't gotten help, and those are the kind of people that really need one of the super shrinks, right? One of the people who have a proven track record of being more effective than the average.
Well, say a little bit more about the research that estimate of 50%, only 50% performing at, you know, at or beyond the median, let's say, or maybe even higher. I don't know how big that slice is. Is that based all on self-report or a mix of self-report and some more objective measures? Do you recall?
Yeah, that's a good question. Really, it's based on the increasing call for evidence base and for people actually gathering data, both on symptom changes using the SCL90, for example, but also on interpersonal problems, how people are actually functioning using the GAF scale. So this is really looking at the relationship between therapist activity, right, their interventions, and the outcomes they're able to achieve. Now, again, the bad news is that our traditional ways of training therapists, believe it or not, there's no evidence that there's a relationship between that traditional method of teaching and supervising and outcomes. Right? Huh. So we keep doing the same thing, even though there's no evidence it's particularly effective. So,
but you're doing training that you believe is effective.
Right, and that we also are doing studies on. But there is evidence that in particular using videotape is highly effective.
Yes.
We are actually seeing what's happening in the session. We're not just basing our, let's say, supervisory comments on the therapist's report.
Right.
Now, the therapist can only report what they're aware of, first of all. So they might have missed all kinds of important things that we could see on the tape. If we don't see it, we can't make use of it.
So in supervision, you review actual sessions, and I assume with the therapist and yourself or a group of supervisees, and you stop the tape periodically to say, okay, what was going on in your mind at that point?
And exactly.
Here's what I would suggest.
That's right. And also pointing out, I mean, we tend to listen a lot, right, to the content. And yet the unconscious speaks nonverbally in the body. And so if a therapist just reported a particular interaction, but I'm not getting the tone, I'm not seeing that the patient is actually looking down at the floor and completely avoiding eye contact with the therapist, then that's a very different picture.
Yeah.
Right? And if I actually see the person is sitting forward, looking at them, they have some energy in their voice. So it's all these kinds of things that are so crucial to effective psychotherapy. It's not just the words, it's the music.
Yeah. Now, there have been something called the common factors, right, of what should be taking place in good psychotherapy, of people being empathic and good listeners. And so, take us through those. You say they're not enough, but let's start with those.
Well, not only are they not enough, but Joel Weinberger wrote a wonderful article back in 1995 that I don't think enough people know about. It's called Common Factors Are Not So Common. Mm-hmm. So first of all, we talk about these common factors. Of course, the relationship factor, right? Having that empathy and connection. One of them, and we often think that is so crucial, and what he found out, and many others have too, is that developing a good collaborative relationship is absolutely essential, but also insufficient for change. So if that's all you're banking on, you might have a nice connection, the patient might enjoy coming to talk to you, but it's not that likely they're actually going to get deep and enduring change. Uh-huh. So you need some other things. So including, and the most potent one that he found was helping the patient confront what he has been avoiding in whatever way you do that.
Okay.
And then subsequent to that is establishing the fact that the patient now has a sense of mastery and competence. So where they may have come in feeling anxious, unsure of themselves, having now confronted what they had avoided and being able then to resolve the issue, of course, their competence and sense of mastery is increased. On top of that, it's really vital that the patient attribute the change to their own efforts.
Now, it sounds like you're going beyond the common factors that he talked about.
Well, he was saying, he went through, so Weinberger did this big meta-analysis, and he actually said that all of those have been considered common factors, and yet that was his whole thing.
I see, that they're not being used.
Common factors are not so common.
Yeah, right.
Even comes to that, we tend not to teach and learn and institute these multiple factors. Most therapies will just focus on one or two of them to the exclusion of the others.
Yeah.
And this is why I think also Bruce Wampold and Bruce Ecker are talking about the common neglect of some of these vital factors as being responsible for the fact that we have not improved as a profession in the last 50 years. You know, despite this proliferation of therapies, over 1,000 different kinds now, all the different diagnostic categories we come up with, but when it comes to that skill and craft of psychotherapy and how to help a specific person with specific problems, we still have a long way to go and have really stagnated for many years.
Yeah, that, I've been hearing that elsewhere from a couple of other guests, and it's a little shocking to hear each time that I hear it, but I don't doubt that it's true. And you know, one of the things that you talk about is the importance of the person, the person's personhood, if you will. And I always thought, well, I'm a good person, and that's just going to be healing in itself. But it's not enough. You say you say there needs to be more than that, and I could be deluded in thinking of that about myself. So, what else is needed beyond personal those personal characteristics?
Yeah. So, and what are those personal characteristics, first of all? So, you know, one of the points I'm really making in this new book is that it's both who we are and what we do that matters, and having those somehow integrated.
Yeah.
So, tend to have these polarities in our field. You know, it goes from all this focus on empirically validated techniques, right? And then when that doesn't pass, oh, no, it's not that. It's just some therapists are better than others. But again, I don't think these simple either-ors tend to build over time. So some of the personal characteristics of the best therapists are not just that they're empathic and understanding, of course that's essential, but they also are lifelong learners. The best therapists are just never done. Mm-hmm. They're open, they're learning, they're open also to the patient's feedback, and they're really hardworking. So the best therapists tend to spend seven times as much time as their average colleague. That's significant, right?
Yeah.
Reading, thinking about, reviewing cases, looking at their tapes, getting supervision, going to seminars, right? So there is no shortcut to mastery in such a complex, you know, profession as we have.
Yeah.
So the other thing about the best therapists is that they really are masters interpersonally. And a big part of that is that they seem to be able to deal with difficult patients, hostile and resistant patients, for example, without themselves getting triggered or being themselves defensive. Mm-hmm. They actually tend to encourage the expression of negative affect.
Yeah.
So instead of trying to, again, to talk somebody out of this, trying to present yourself as this nice, understanding person, you know, you'd say, boy, you seem really angry. You know, right off the bat, there's kind of an antagonistic tone here. Are you aware of that? Yeah. So you have a lot of anger already coming in. Can we have a look at that?
Yeah. Yeah.
They're not put off by it. They actually encourage it. So there are a lot of very sophisticated sort of skills and personal characteristics of courage and determination. So that even if you teach somebody these skills in a training seminar, you know, will they be able to use them under fire?
Uh-huh. That takes a lot of practice, right? A lot of practice, a lot of feedback.
It does.
Yeah.
And again, that commitment, I think, to our own personal development, our ability to be able to sort of, as I say to my students often, you know, we have to get over ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, is it about you? And can you really, you know, be willing to devote yourself to the care and well-being of this other person, even when they're very difficult to
interact
with?
Yeah. So beyond those common factors that we were talking about earlier, you make a case for very specific factors, which you've been getting at, and as being vital for effective therapy. And you list six specific factors, and I'd like to read through them, and I'll read through them, and then we'll step through them one at a time, and and I'd like to encourage you to just expound on each one with whatever comes to mind to expand it, and to give any sorts of concrete examples that might come to mind, because your book is loaded with solid examples and case examples.
Mm-hmm.
So to go through the six, the first one is maintain a high level of focus. The second is develop an atmosphere of trust by displaying skill and competence and being a resource for patients and students. Build a collaborative alliance in which both participants give 100% of their effort to the task. I think you've been foreshadowing this in what you've been saying already. Facilitate intense involvement in which multiple modes of experience, cognitive, emotional, physical, and interpersonal, are facilitated and integrated. Number four is keep anxiety and stress in the moderate range. That's an interesting one. Alternating with periods of calm consolidation. Number five is encourage profound moments of meeting by encouraging the removal of barriers to intimacy and closeness. And then finally, number six, develop meaning and a coherent life narrative. So let's start off with number one, maintain a high level of focus. What is that about?
Yes, indeed. I'm happy to get into that. Now, before I do, I just want to say that these six factors it's not something I came up with, and it's not just my opinion.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so both process research, not RCTs where we're just comparing CBT and ISTDP, but we're really looking at what are you actually doing? You know, not what do you call it, but what are you doing? So this process research, and then also some new brain neuroscientific research, they seem to agree that these six factors are required to change an adult brain and to actually get deep and lasting therapeutic change as the result of therapeutic intervention.
I just want to underscore one thing here, which is your commitment to empirical research and your strong belief that, you know, even though you kind of did quotes around, what is the term that we're using now, that everything evidence-based, there, you know, that...
Despite
whatever criticisms there are of that, you're still a strong believer that our work has to be supported empirically.
That's right. And the difference, again, being not talking about empirical validation for an entire model like CBT or ISTDP. Because when we do that, all these RCTs always come out with the same result, which is that all the therapies are helpful, but none more than the other.
What are those initials you're using, those RSTs?
Oh, sorry. So randomized clinical trials.
Thank you.
Where they're comparing large groups, one being treated, for example, with CBT and the other with ISTDP. So you're comparing groups and you're comparing models. Again, what somebody calls what they're doing. And when we do that, and we've been doing those, again, for 50 years, spending a lot of time and money, and getting the same result over and over again, what happens is all the variation goes out in the wash. So the within-group variation is greater than between groups. So it doesn't matter what you call what you do. What matters is what you actually do.
Yes.
And that's where process research comes in. So we can actually look at what is the effect of having a focus, right? That was our first topic here.
Yes.
What effect does that have on outcome? And it's actually quite significant. So therapists who take some charge of the sessions, actively focusing the patient on their areas of difficulty, on the symptom-generating situations, and in particular, what we would call an internal focus. All too often, therapists sit and listen to patients talk about other people.
Yeah.
Complaining about the boss or their kids or their husband. This doesn't help anybody. So how can we say, you know, I understand that it sounds like your husband has some difficulties with drinking, but my real concern, I mean, you're the one who's here to see me, is what are the difficulties you're having in dealing with that? So how we create and then maintain this internal focus and getting agreement on what we are actually here to address has a very significant relationship to outcome. Conversely, those therapies that are unfocused, you know, where people kind of shoot from the hip and go with the flow and so on, actually are associated with negative outcome.
Uh-huh.
So focus on both levels, the more you sustain an agreed upon focus, the better your outcome is likely to be. And a failure to focus will set you up for failure.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about the internal focus, are you talking not just about the therapist has to stay on point within themselves, but also you're hoping that the client will begin to adapt a similar concern?
Yeah, and it's not really, in a way, about hope. I mean, it really is that unless and until the patient sitting in your office can identify a problem that they are having internally, their own conflict, you really can't do therapy. You can't do psychotherapy. You can give advice, you can do problem solving, but psychotherapy, right, is a therapy of the psyche, of the internal world of the patient. How whatever their life circumstances are is actually affecting them internally. What's that stirring up that they are struggling with?
Mm-hmm.
In a way, unless you develop this agreement that you're there to help this patient with their internal problem, then you as the therapist are in somewhat of a helpless position.
Yeah.
There's nothing you can really do about the patient's boss or, you know, these external things. So it helps both the patient and the therapist to get clear about the internal nature of the problems to be addressed.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the patient who comes in expecting a magic bullet and they're not really owning the issues themselves. They're not really struggling. They're, okay, I'm giving this to you.
That's right.
You're the expert. Tell me what to do.
That's a great example. So as long as that patient is using the defenses of externalization and also taking a helpless position, looking at you as omnipotent, those defenses are going to interfere with the development of the kind of collaborative relationship required to do psychotherapy.
Yeah, great.
So therapists have to make sure they don't fall into that trap, right? Where they somehow think that they're the ones, right, who are going to cure this patient, right? As I often say, I've never cured anybody, but I do help facilitate a healing process, right? That the cure takes place internally.
Yeah, great. Let's move on to your second specific skill, I guess. Develop an atmosphere of trust by displaying skill and competence and being a resource for patients and students. Build a collaborative alliance. That's kind of what we were just getting at.
Exactly.
Build a collaborative alliance in which both participants give 100% of their effort to the task.
That's right. So again, these things do sort of flow. We can just see that even in our conversation, right? That even getting that agreement on the focus requires that the two of you are collaborating. You're working together to try to understand the underlying nature of the symptoms the patient is complaining about. You want to be getting an agreement then about what the goals are so that you could also agree about then what is the task. So given that this A is the problem and you want to be over here, this is your goal, then what do we have to do to get from here to there? So again, developing this collaborative alliance is much more than just having an emotional bond, which is what many people think of when we talk about a therapeutic alliance.
Mm-hmm.
Again, just liking a therapist or seeing them as sympathetic is not enough. So getting this agreement on the problem and the goal and the task is an essential part of that collaboration. And as you're doing that, in fact, you are displaying your skill and your competence.
Mm-hmm.
And you are also inviting the patient to become actively involved. And in a way, this is really what I call the reality principle. If the patient is sitting there passively, not really involved, waiting for you to come up, how likely is that to happen? Right? So that's just the reality. If they're not willing, so this is where we'll actually ask. And I think therapists often don't ask their patients for anything. You know, it's this one-way street. I will ask for their willingness. I ask, are they willing to be open, right? And to see what we can do together. Are they willing to give 100% of their effort along with me so that we can see what we can really do here?
Yeah.
So that's absolutely essential.
In your number three competence, you kind of turn the knob a little bit further to facilitate intense involvement in which multiple modes of experience, cognitive, emotional, physical, and interpersonal, are facilitated and integrated.
That's right. So this is really all about, we've known since, you know, Frank long ago, Alexander and French, you know, decades and decades ago, that an intellectual kind of therapy, whether it's psychoanalysis or CBT, alone is not likely to reach a lot of people in a deep transformational way. We have to create an emotionally activated environment. But how do you do that? Right. So unless you know how to really keep your eye on emotion, to ask the patient how they're feeling as you begin to get into different areas, even focusing them on their own difficulties, not allowing them just to talk on and on about others, you might see a rise of emotion, right? They might suddenly start to cry or to seem angry and annoyed with you for interrupting them. So again, we would invite this experience of emotion, which is so crucial to getting to the unconscious origin of the patient's problems. And I'm talking about the levels of emotional experiencing. So this has become, I think, very popular now these days, right? There's this general understanding that emotional awareness and regulation is absolutely key. Even in CBT, the third wave, they say, oh yes, we're talking about emotions. Mm-hmm. So they might focus on the cognitive labeling of emotions. Emotion-focused therapy might focus on the actual experience in the body of that. Somatic experiencing talks about the physiological activation and what the body wants to do when angry or sad, right? And then we're also talking about how to interpersonally communicate those emotions. So the more you can access and again integrate multiple levels of emotional experiencing, not just cognitive, not just physical, but all of them, it's much more likely that the patient not only is getting deeply involved in the therapy, but it looks like that deep visceral experience of the previously avoided emotion is actually the trigger that tends to unlock the unconscious memories and sources of the conflicts and the problems that the patient is coming in with. So it's really a very rapid and reliable route to getting to the bottom of it, getting to the engine of the patient's symptoms and suffering.
You say very rapid, and that brings us back to the name of this approach of being short-term.
Yes.
So that this is what tends to speed it up is keeping this this level of emotional focus. And
yes.
And you early on, you emphasize that some of this is based on research on the brain, and
yes.
That for long-lasting and significant change, that these emotional levels have to be involved. And that leads into your fourth competency here, which is keep anxiety and stress in the moderate range, alternating with periods of calm consolidation. So in other words, you don't want them just to be too relaxed.
That's right. So this is something that, and maybe these two, both the emotional activation we were just talking about and this issue of being able to keep the patient a little uncomfortable, right, where they're actually anxious. You're approaching those hot button topics. I mean, that's what we're there to do. So if you keep avoiding that, if you keep anxiety too low, no change really happens. And so it is a bit like Goldilocks, you know, if there's not enough anxiety, nothing will happen. If anxiety is so high that the patient is starting to get dizzy or dissociate, obviously, you don't have a patient in the room to work with, and that's not going to be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So really watching, because this is going to be different for every patient, and even with them different session to session, that you're watching for what we call signals of anxiety to make sure that anxiety is in that optimal zone and not too high. So we do want the person to be a little uncomfortable and approaching the very things they tend to avoid so that we can help them deal with it and resolve it in some constructive manner.
I'm wondering if this is challenging for some therapists to be able to turn up the level of anxiety, and if maybe it's just not in their personal style. Or maybe they have needs to be liked, and so it's threatening to move into that. What's been your experience there?
Yes, I think those are really good comments. And this is where I feel that we have a responsibility as therapists to push ourselves. And it's, again, to get over ourselves, right? It's not about me being comfortable, right? So I have to be able to tolerate some of my own anxiety, right, in order to confront what needs confronting, right? Yeah. Sometimes very much directly between the two of us. If there's been, you know, some kind of acting out, for example, in the treatment with people canceling, not paying, whatever, you know, it might be anxiety provoking to bring it up directly. And yet that is our job. That is our task. And this is where I think ongoing training and supervision is so important, because if you as the therapist have to be comfortable, I mean, how are you going to help your patient, you know, deal with their discomfort? And this is another thing that I repeat frequently, I think, in the book as well as in my trainings, which is that we have to be willing to practice what we preach. And if we're not willing to tolerate anxiety for growth, mm-hmm. how can we, with any integrity, you know, encourage our patients to do the same?
Yeah.
And believe me, our patients are keeping an eye on us all the time, and they're reading us, and they can read whether we're anxious or not, whether we really mean what we say and are willing to have an honest look at what's going on with them, willing to face these very difficult feelings mm-hmm. that they might have, including toward us, right? The things that come up. So they're going to test us out. And this is why our own personal work, dealing with our own anxieties, our own conflictual feelings, being willing to put down our own defenses, is absolutely essential to effective psychotherapy.
Yeah, this raises an interesting question of, I think there are a lot of doctoral programs out there that do not require that the therapists that they're training be in therapy. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, this is, you know, certainly my personal opinion. I'm troubled by that. And I think that as the field got more and more cognitive over the last, you know, several decades, mm-hmm. you know, they just thought it wasn't important. You're just dealing with conscious, rational thoughts that people are having. But to do any kind of depth-oriented work, emotional work, again, I think it's our responsibility to make sure that we're a relatively open, uncontaminated space. So it's something, I mean, in our country, I don't think we can demand these things, but certainly in my experience, most therapists who want to do this kind of work just go voluntarily. I mean, you don't even have to ask them. Yeah. At other times, you know, in supervision, if the trainee isn't learning, you know, and you're having to repeat that there, again, is some kind of emotional block, or their anxiety is so high that they can't really process the feedback, right, then they really are going to need to get some help themselves in order to be able to clear that up. And again, be that space where they can be truly available to their patients and not getting triggered so quickly themselves.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, we are the vehicle of transmission of the therapy itself. And so as such, we can't really remove ourselves, right, from the equation. Yeah. So that's, again, it's who we are in our being as well as what we do that really matters.
Sure. Okay, point number five is encourage profound moments of meeting by encouraging the removal of barriers to intimacy and closeness.
Yes. So again, it never ceases to amaze me how therapists, and of course, this is what I get to see when I'm watching the videotapes, which I will not do supervision without anymore. I just feel I can't do a competent job without actually seeing what's happening there. And I will literally see videotapes where the patient comes in, they sit down, arms crossed, legs crossed, hat on, coat on, eyes to the floor. Yeah. And the therapist starts talking as if they have a patient in the room.
Uh-huh.
So they're not addressing all of the barriers to the patient's presence and engagement. So when that is apparent, we must address it. You know, are you aware, you know, that there's a way in which you're here but not here? Mm-hmm. I mean, physically you're present, but your eyes are to the floor, your coat's on, you're curled up, you know, you're very much, right? Are you aware of that? You know, you must be anxious about being here. Can we look into it? You know, and again, are you willing to connect here with me so we can try to understand what's going on? Without the patient's willingness to be open, present, and engaged, it doesn't matter how many great skills you have.
No.
The patient isn't available to it, right? So these are the kinds of things that have to be addressed, and the patient has to be willing to remove these walls, these barriers, if we're going to have the kind of engagement that's going to result in an outcome that they're looking for.
Again, I think the challenge for the trainee therapist, is to be confrontive, to, you know, be able to get over whatever blocks they have against being confrontive, and somehow not to be attacking. I mean, that's kind of a fine balance, right? To,
absolutely,
you know, how you're going to say it in a way that is not received as attacking.
That's right.
Yeah. How do you do that?
Both your tone is really important. You know, so sometimes people will read my books and they read all these transcripts. They're actual transcripts. And they're getting a certain image in their mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
Reading it and they're thinking, oh gosh, that sounds really confronting, like you say. And then they'll come to a workshop and they actually see that case that they had just read and they say, oh my gosh, but it didn't feel confronting because your tone was so different.
Uh-huh.
So that's really important, that you have to make sure that you're not, in fact, attacking the patient because you're angry and impatient or whatever. That I like to think of it much more as an invitation, and that it's also back to reality principle. So I might say, I'd really like to be able to help you. I can only do that if you're willing to open up here. You know, mm-hmm, I can't do it without your cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
So would you be willing, right, to open up here with me, to make a connection so that we can see if we can work together? And I find that people are very responsive both to these kind of willing questions.
Okay.
You know, willing. Uh-huh. Would you be willing to give it a try? Would you be willing just to do an experiment? Let's see what it's like, uh-huh, right? And I wonder what kinds of feelings come up. You know, you must be anxious. So when they realize, oh yeah, when I look at you, woo, you know, my anxiety goes way up. So that it's understandable, right, that when you shut down and withdraw, your anxiety goes down. Well, in a way, that's the good news. But the bad news is you create a barrier here. You shut down, and the very things you need help with, you don't raise. So looks like that has a cost to it also. So that you're then helping the patient really see that they're in conflict, right, that what they're wanting and how they're engaging are not in alignment, right? And what are they going to need to be able to do to get the outcome they're hoping for?
Yeah. Well, the sixth point is develop meaning and a coherent life narrative. Why is that important? We've got the emotion, we've got the anxiety, we've got all these other elements.
Right. And in a way, they're all leading up to this final factor, which is that it's much more likely that you're actually going to discover the unconscious origin of the patient's symptoms and suffering if you create a highly focused, emotionally charged atmosphere in which the two of you are working closely together. You know, that eye contact is activating the whole unconscious attachment system. And so it's much more likely that as you engage in that way, the patient's unconscious will open, right? And literally, patients will say, oh my God, it's so weird. It's almost like I just had this flash in front of my eyes. I totally forgot this, but I just saw, you know, my grandfather standing in the, and they have this memory
of
when literally You know, they made the decision that anger was dangerous and they must never feel it again. So it's a very rapid and reliable route to the de-repression of these crucial memories that help us make sense of the origin of the patient's conflicts. Once we do that and the unconscious is now conscious, the adult ego, right, the adult patient along with you have a chance to reevaluate decisions that were made when the patient was 3 years old.
Yeah.
and often, and literally, I've had patients just, you know, look at me and say, this changes everything. I mean, this is what we mean by transformational change. It's rapid, but deep and enduring. That there was some deep unconscious belief that had been operating all these years. And that once that is de-repressed, comes to the light of day, and the patient realizes that's ridiculous. I mean, that's, you know, and as one of my patients said, you know, I sort of vaguely remember the way I used to be. I mean, I know I was incredibly masochistic. I just couldn't do that again if you paid me $1 million. I mean, it couldn't happen now.
Yeah.
So something changes very fundamentally in the patient's sense of themselves. And because they are now able to remember, right, the incidents that formed those initial conflicts, those initial beliefs, many things that made no sense to them coming in, first of all, makes sense now.
Yeah.
Well, often patients will say, I don't know why I do this. I mean, I know that washing my hands the 75th time isn't actually going to do anything, yeah, but I can't help it. You know, they're a mystery to themselves. And so as these memories are de-repressed, following the experience of these anxiety-provoking affects, they can suddenly understand that, oh my God, now it all makes sense. Now I see it. And then compassion for the self comes quite naturally. It's not something you have to teach someone to do, right? They see what happened. They understand themselves. Mm-hmm. Often they will now understand others in a new and more nuanced three-dimensional way. And so when this happens, patients are no longer triggered. It literally has been resolved at the source. So they don't have to try to manage their anxiety or manage their OCD. The need for the symptom is gone.
Mm-hmm.
It's resolved. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's what we really mean by transformational change, which I think is always our goal. Not that we always get that result, but that kind of freedom where the patient is no longer being triggered and having to manage symptoms.
Okay.
Let me just say one more thing about the coherent life narrative. We also know from all the attachment research that having a coherent life narrative is highly associated with secure functioning. So for a mother or a father to be able to create a secure relationship with their children, they need to have their own coherent life narrative. So even though I treat individuals, what I end up seeing with this kind of work, which is, again, so gratifying, is that as they change in a deep and profound way, the nature of their relationships with others changes, and they're able now to begin to create and maintain secure, healthy relationships with other people in their family and at work. So you do see this sort of outward spiral, just as one person can take others down, right? I've also seen one person in a family system or it would really be able to be a healing force in their life.
Mm-hmm. How has doing this kind of intense, emotionally focused work impacted you?
That it's a great question. I mean, it's had a profound impact on me. Certainly, I have expanded enormously in my capacity to tolerate all kinds of intense mixed feelings within myself and from others without getting anxious, without having to get defensive. And as I do that, of course, the depth of connection and the ability to have really deep, meaningful, intimate relationships has also expanded. But there's, I think, another side to it. I know many therapists who started with this work and really did remarkable work. I saw it. I saw it on videotape. The most profound healing and transformations with patients. And I saw them over the years give it up and start to move away from it and start to go back to sort of, you know, loose, maybe sort of empathic, supportive. And I'm thinking, what in the world is going on here?
Yeah, really.
But I'm telling you, because I've been doing this for 30 years now, doing it myself, teaching it, supervising it. And while we get these wonderful outcomes, in order to get there, we often go to hell and back with patients. And it takes a toll on us to be, especially because, again, we invite feelings very directly toward ourselves. Mm-hmm. The patients are fantasizing, you know, beating me up, raping me, killing me, you know. And so, you know, I have a certain, you know, I realize, okay, that's in there. There's a therapeutic reason for that, right? And we get through that. And of course, then the patient feels tremendous guilt and sorrow about it. And then they connect to their love. And of course, that gets linked to unresolved things from the past. So there's all a good reason for it. But yeah, to be confronted with this day in and day out, along with the traumas, of course, that have given rise to these intense reactive feelings toward others, I think we really are at risk of some secondary trauma. And so unless we have support in our own lives, people that we can talk to. I mean, I remember this was only a few months ago. I was seeing a patient for the first time. And when I do that, I always schedule 3 hours. And this is something I learned from Dr. Davenport and is really a vital part of ISTDP, an extended initial interview, so that we really have a chance to actually do the work in that first meeting. And it greatly accelerates the process.
Wow.
So this man came to see me. He had been suffering for 20 years, not only with anxiety, sort of OCD symptoms, depression, and every conceivable ache and pain and all kinds of unexplained medical symptoms. He had been to every doctor in the area. He had gone through every possible test. And he finally himself was convinced that there was no organic cause. And he knew that it was emotionally based and he wanted to get to the bottom of it. And so he did some research and found out that, you know, ISTDP is a treatment that's effective with pain syndromes and unexplained medical symptoms. So he comes to see me. And quite rapidly, he was really open, very cooperative, and highly motivated. And quickly, it became apparent that his pain would flare up around issues where anger was getting activated, but he suppressed it. It went quite quickly back to his father, who was a really brutal, sadistic kind of guy. And so as we were talking about this and I was asking for some examples, and he remembered how his father would taunt him with things like him being a sissy and a patsy ass and things like this. And he would dunk him in the swimming pool repeatedly, wanting him to fight back, this kind of thing. So I'm asking now, how do you actually feel that anger inside in the body? Right. Because I want that activation. And he said, well, there's a little bit, not that much, maybe 20% of what I know is there. So I'm like, okay, how are we going to get, more activation? So I ask him, all right, so if you think about the thing you are most angry with your father about, so we can really help you get in touch with this, what would you say that is? And he pauses, and then he looks right at me, and he said, well, I guess that would have to be that he murdered my mother. And then he killed himself, and I'm the one who found them.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah.
Oh, my God, David. I literally felt like I can't even describe it. I mean, I was almost overwhelmed with, man's inhumanity to man, what people have to deal with. And I mean, of course, I held it together. I did my best, and I think I actually was able to help him. But I tell you, I staggered out of my office that day. And I just, knew I needed somebody to talk to, somebody to, So I think that this is why a lot of us shy away from this, because it is so difficult to deal with. And it's tempting, to want to skim the surface or avoid these horrendous things. But this is what our patients are carrying around with them, So I think it's, it's affected me, as I say, in all these ways. I feel the wonderful joy more deeply, and I also feel the pain and the horror, So I think it's very important when doing this kind of work to limit how many hours you do, how many patients you see.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. What would be your rule of thumb in
Definitely.
That regard?
I think people are different, so you have to gauge for yourself. And it's different for me now than it was, years ago, because I'm doing a lot of teaching and supervision. So I'm probably only seeing, patients 2 or 3 days a week. But you just have to, again, keep in touch with yourself and know when are you working at your optimal level? Are you getting tired? Are you starting to detach? And what do you need to restore yourself? Mm-hmm. I took up tennis a couple of years ago. I paint. I have other, as well as having a really rich network, of friends and a good, social life.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I think these things are really important to keep our eye on.
Right. Well, that could be a good close for the interview here, a good place to wrap it up. Or maybe there's some other thing that you've wanted to say but didn't get a chance
to. Yeah, I think the only other thing I would say is that exactly what we're doing, David, is part of this, being able to talk to each other about how difficult this work is, mm-hmm. as well as how rewarding it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is why I now do training groups that are very cohesive and they stay together for a number of years. And I just find that people's learning is much deeper and because we're supporting each other. It's a lonely profession.
Right.
We're in there by ourselves. So I'm so appreciative that you're doing this kind of work where you're talking to therapists and also supporting us to be learning constantly, right? Which is the other thing. That's another way to feed ourselves and stay fresh is to listen to what other people are doing. Read outside of your narrow, model, right? Mm-hmm. We can always be learning from other people, other methods. And so I think that's all really important. And I'm just very grateful to you for the service that you're providing to all of us.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate You're being so inspirational. I feel very inspired just talking to you, and I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much, David.
I'm very much impressed by Dr. Patricia Coughlin. I love the way she came across in this interview, especially in the video. She's a great example of the sort of presence and approach that she advocates. If I were to start a psychotherapy practice again, I'd have to seriously consider getting training and supervision from her. I didn't mention it to her in the interview, but for many years, while I was a professor at Sonoma State University, I taught an undergraduate counseling class. Students were organized into co-counseling pairs and urged not to role play, but to work on real issues in their lives. Some of them got very deep. We had examples in the classes of those who were really good in terms of being willing to open up and share their own deep issues, as well as students who, in the counselor role, showed tremendous talent. I was really throwing them into the deep end of the pool, trusting to human resilience. Since many of the students hoped to go on to graduate school to become therapists, I wanted to give them a taste of what they might be in for. I might even go so far as to say what they would be in for if they got into a really strong clinical training program, because a key component of my class was that each student pair would do a session in which they were videotaped, and the tape would then be reviewed in front of the whole class with a critique by me and my assistant, and also feedback from the class. I doubt that there were many, if any, other places where undergraduate students could receive this sort of intense experiential and supervisory experience. I strongly recommend Dr. Patricia Coughlin's book to all present and future therapists in my audience. As always, you're encouraged to purchase it, Maximizing Effectiveness and Dynamic Psychotherapy, by using the Amazon affiliate widget in our right-hand sidebar.
Hey, Dr. Dave, it's Mike the Mailman from beautiful Asheville, North Carolina, and I just wanted to take an opportunity and thank you for all the hard work that you put into these podcasts at Shrink Wrap Radio, and to give you that good shot in the arm, I have become a monthly donor, and I would encourage other listeners to go to the webpage and hit that big multiple color donate button and give you that great shot in the arm. So again, Dr. Dave, thank you very much.
Well, hey, Mike the Mailman, you've definitely given me a big shot in the arm, both by your donation and the fine call to action to all those who are listeners but not donors. So if you're not already a financial supporter, I hope you'll join Mike the Mailman as a donor. And I'm happy to announce that we do have a new transcript on the site. It's number 489, The Promise of Technology for the Aging Brain, with Dr. Adam Ghazali, MD. Thanks to Barclay Labrasseur for doing that. That was a really terrific interview that I'm very happy to have on the site. Let me mention again that we're coming into that gift-giving time of year. If you end up buying gifts on Amazon.com, the everything store, please remember to use our Amazon.com affiliate widget in the right-hand sidebar on shrinkwrapradio.com. You can use that widget to shop for more than just books. Using it, you can navigate to any section of the Amazon site, and your purchases will be tagged as coming from Shrink Wrap Radio, and it's just another way that you can help to support the show. I will really appreciate it. Hey, if you're a health and wellness provider, such as a yoga therapist, naturopath, acupuncturist, life coach, chiropractor, midwife, or any other of a host of health and wellness providers, then it's a pretty safe bet that one of your top priorities is going to be growing your practice. That's where Swellbee.com comes in. They have created a new online marketplace for health and wellness providers to list their services. When you add your business profile to their online site, new clients will be able to find you, as well as book and pay for services through this HIPAA-compliant site. It's simple and easy to use. It's Wellbe.com, and right now you can sign up to use the service for free.
Hi, I'm John Fredrickson, author of the 2013 book, Co-Creating Change, Effective Dynamic Therapy Techniques. And you're on the couch now with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, John Fredrickson, whom I interviewed on episode number 365, Effective Dynamic Therapy Techniques. That episode is actually an excellent companion piece for today's interview. And I should mention that I'll be interviewing him again sometime in the month of January. So you can expect more on intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy. Can you tell I'm a big fan? Now let's go to a recent email from our listener community. This one comes from Julian in Australia, who writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. This is a rather belated email from me, as I have been listening and admiring for many years and making monthly contributions for a few. I'm a clinical psychologist in public mental health in rural Australia and have also been involved to some degree in a local university master's program in clinical psychology. My reading, study, and work over recent years has increasingly led me to think along lines espoused by you, namely, that there's something of a confluence occurring in psychology which renders some of the old distinctions between schools, etc., somewhat obsolete, as well as the advances being made in the field of neuropsychology, which seem to very much tie in to the attachment-based and trauma-based theories. It seems that increasing understanding of our evolutionary heritage in terms of the brain/mind we have inherited and how it works is also becoming increasingly woven into the way that we understand ourselves. At the World Conference of the Association for Contextual Behavioral Science in Sydney in 2013, I was introduced to the work of people such as Eva Jablonka and Paul Gilbert. After reading more of Paul Gilbert's work, namely the book The Compassionate Mind, I think he would make an excellent guest on your wonderful podcast. He ties in so much of what we know about ourselves in an evolutionary sense into a rich, compassion-based approach. I think I heard another listener recommend him as a guest and would like to endorse that recommendation. Oh, for a discussion from a purely evolutionary perspective, I wonder whether Eva Jablonka would be willing or have time to be interviewed. Her book, Evolution in Four Dimensions, might be a starting point to get you interested. It also seems to me that relational frame theory, RFT, will likely make its presence felt for some time to come in the field of psychology. It certainly seems to me to be a bit of a finding the key to fit the lock situation as to how our brain works in its utilization of symbolic representations and how this relates to the earlier, more primary functions of our brain, which also still live on strongly. I'd love to hear you devote an interview to RFT, be it with Steve Hayes again, or perhaps John T. Blackledge, one of the main protagonists in this field. A further recommendation I would like to make would be Professor Russell Mears, a psychiatrist based in Sydney, Australia, who is the main person behind an approach called the conversational mind. He's authored some great books, The Metaphor of Play in 1992, Intimacy and Alienation in 2000, and A Dissociation Model of Borderline Personality Disorder in 2012. This approach is used with more significantly psychologically disturbed clients, for example, those fulfilling criteria for borderline personality disorder, and works with the sense of self as it arises in the flux and nuances of conversation. I've heard numerous talks by Russell Mears, many at psychevisual.com, and am thus aware that he is a very erudite and engaging speaker. Thank you so much, Dr. David Van Nuys, for the wonderful resource you have created and continue to expand. It is quite priceless, and I'm glad that you have lived in a time when technology means that I and many others are able to easily sup on the fruits you provide via podcast. For me, often while I'm driving, gardening, renovating, or walking the dog. I hope that your enthusiasm and health hold up for a long time to come so that this great work can continue. The rich resource being created continue to expand, and we listeners and the field of psychology, and hopefully perhaps even the world in general, can continue to benefit. Thanks so much from Australia. Warmest regards, Julian wrote. P.S. Some months ago, after numerous wines, I had a go at some rap words for your show. I can either throw them out or send them, so what the hell, I'll send them. So here is his wine-infused rap, which I am encouraging him to maybe send in his own voice with or without music. So we'll see if that happens, but I'm going to take a chance on putting them out here, and I am no rapper. An attitude of gratitude is what we're talking about. When Dr. Dave is on the airwaves with a psychological clout, we take it in, we soak it up, we're drinking from the golden cup. And every day that we don't pay is another where we can't stay. Hey, I did my bit to keep up all this fantastic shit. And if I don't or if I won't and Dr. Dave falls into a financial pit, well, I will weep, I will moan, because Shrink Wrap Podcast is no longer going. Its goose is cooked, its sheep is shorn. I could have stopped this if I had known that all good things don't come for free. It was up to me. It is up to we. So the more of us, we, that hit the big support button, the more likely Dr. Dave's show will be saved from shutting. Okay, Julian, that's very refreshing. Thank you so much for your support and your enthusiasm. And that's quite a long to-do list of suggested interviewees, but let me see what I can do. Seems like there are many excellent suggestions there, many of whom I have not heard of. In fact, I have been trying to get Paul Gilbert, and we thought we had an interview scheduled, but due to some miscommunication, it just didn't happen. I'll have to see if I can fire that up again. So with that, I think we better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails, as always, to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Or we have an app for that. Just look at the apps tab on shrinkwrapradio.com. Thanks to Dr. Patricia Coughlin for re-sparking our interest and enthusiasm for intensive short-term psychodynamic therapy. My next interview will be with R. Michael Anderson, M.A., serial entrepreneur, spiritually oriented business coach, speaker, and author. So I do hope you will join us then. And for now, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.